Hi, welcome to another edition of the PCRF podcast. My name is Dave Page, and I'm a board of directors member for the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum. I'm here with
Marshall Washick, paramedic with Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Josh Salzman, the director of critical care research at Regents Hospital in St. Paul.
Aaron Burnett, the assistant medical director at Regents Hospital EMS.
Charlie Lick, medical director, Atlanta Medical Transportation in the Twin Cities.
And we are here today to discuss, I have learned today a new word, the pentology and that's five different IO. I knew the word for trilogy, but I just got stumped with the five. So five different papers that have just come out on intraosseous. And this is a kind of a topic we've, I think, seen before. We just covered it like a month or two ago on a sternal IO study. But we think that these five studies have a story to tell together, and it was worth it to just briefly describe each one of them. So we're going to start with the strongest one, one that has the best research to it. And that one comes to us from none other than our friend Jonathan Studnick at Carolinas. He is, I'm eternally proud of the fact that paramedics are doing research here. And Dr. Rosalind Reeds is the lead author. So they their title is Intraosseous versus Intravenous Vascular Access During Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest, a Randomized Controlled Trial. It was published just this month in Annals of Emergency Medicine, so a very prestigious journal and very timely publication. Now, what they did, it's a prospective randomized study, so that means we're approaching the gold standard here of, you know, randomized controlled, and it couldn't be blinded because people would actually have to pick the needle that they're going to use. So it was hard to blind them to this, but again, really the gold standard of research. And what they chose to compare three different routes of IV access. One being a tibial IO, the next one being humeral insertion of an IO, and the last one being an intravenous line, establishing an IV line. And they got 182 patients that were enrolled. 64 of them were assigned to tibial IO, intraosseous, and 51 of them got assigned to humeral intraosseous, 67 got peripheral IVs. So first off, you always want to look at whether the randomization worked and whether the groups are fairly equal, and it does seem like the groups were fairly equal here. They looked at the time to establish the particular route and also whether it was successful on first attempt. And in this case, there were 130 patients who were who had so 71% of these patients who experienced initial vascular access success with the about 17 of them, 9% of the needles becoming dislodged. So overall, first attempt success rate is 62%. Now, they went down and looked at each one of these techniques. And of course, the punchline here is that tibial IO access seems to be bunker tight, 91%, really a high and very fast success and high success rate. The next one they looked at, believe it or not, was the next one in the list that comes out ahead is humeral access. And that's 51% overall, but I do notice that it was 71% on initial access. It's just that about 20% of them get dislodged. So that's a really interesting issue, because when we talk about the next study didn't have as many of those dislodgements. So something's happening over at Mecklenburg EMS where when they're doing a cardiac arrest and they're trying to work on getting humeral access, there maybe it's a part of the torso. They describe that in the paper, but they're having trouble keeping him in once they get him in. And I was actually really surprised and disappointed to see a 43% success rate on IV attempts. That's for initial IV access. I thought we were better than that. And I think, by the way, Mecklenburg is a great service. So there's no question here that their paramedics are top notch. That's not it. But I don't think we would be any better if we actually kept track of it. And I think, clearly, if you want to get a line in and you want to get it fast, you go to the tibia. So any comments about this particular one?
Sure. Well, interestingly, the low peripheral IV rate, and really, you're right, though, if we all looked at our data, we might be surprised, too. But somebody in cardiac arrest, everything's backed up into the venous system. You know, let's face it, most of these patients have big honking veins. You look down there, and why is it so difficult? Not all of them. The other comment I have is, you know, we've been practicing the tibial approach for forever. And I think most of us have been trained and retrained on those landmarks. The humeral approach is something new. And I'm sure the training was good in this study and all, too. But let's face it, if we've done it the same way or the same landmarks, especially in an emergency situation like this, it's going to be easier to recognize. And the dislodgement is worrisome because is this just a logistical issue? All the things are going on around the patient's torso and head. CPR is going on, airway. If you've got the IV up there also, does that argue for this tibial approach where it's down away from the rest of the activity, too?
I think if you, it's a great point, Charlie, if you look at table one, if you're looking at the paper, they do reference that the differences in weight between the groups was significant for those patients treated with the humeral approach. So they did a good job of characterizing their population to figure out, was there potentially a reason that a humeral IO wouldn't work? And it appears that weight in this population for the humeral IO on average was 104 kilograms. But when you compare it to the tibial IO patients, it's about 14 kilograms higher. So that may have been a factor that should be taken into account when reading the results of the paper here.
Absolutely. You know, the only regret I have on this particular paper was that unless I'm missing it, I keep looking over it, but I can't find
the length
of the needles.
I was also going to point that out. They don't document if they use the 25 millimeter or they use the larger 45.
It's really unfortunate because that's the only real sort of question in my mind about these larger patients is whether or not they went with a larger needle and could have made a difference. And in the next paper, we're going to talk about it certainly did make a difference, or at least they did discuss it. So,
you know, getting back to Dr. Lick's point in terms of we're good at what we do the most, looking at table three, it really talks about what was the provider's comfort with each of the different devices. And tibial IO has a higher comfort level from the providers as compared to humeral. And maybe as we get more comfortable with this humeral approach, we do more studies, we'll see that it's not as bad as we think it is right now. But the key takeaway from this is that if you're on a cardiac arrest, you should really be reaching for an intraosseous device and not an IV catheter.
And Aaron, just to piggyback off that, if you look at the protocol violation data that they include, they had 13 of them that favored just going straight to the tibial placement, regardless of what the randomization card said. And although that may have just been random chance, I think in the end it really does show that provider bias can be a factor. And even a well-designed study that you intentionally make sure or really work hard to make sure that people are treating them to the assigned group, that if you're not comfortable, you're treating a patient in cardiac arrest, you know, forget the study, let's treat the patient. And it seems that this would be a good indicator that there may have been some of that going on.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see how we sort of wreck a good study, really. It's horrible.
IV may be important, but we've never really shown that any of these drugs really do anything anyway.
Oh, yeah.
And how much time are we screwing around with the darn IV when we're not defibrillating the patient and doing outstanding CPR?
Seriously. There may be an increase in outcome success rates only because we didn't waste time on the IV, not because of anything we gave to the IV, but because, you know, it was that. But and their study does point out that they were not looking at outcomes intentionally. So, we'll give them we don't even have to give them a break. They did good research. They met their objective.
All right. It was a nice study.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. So Wampler here in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine, it was accepted in July 2011, but it just published here. It's still in press, and we're talking December 2011, has a paper called Paramedics Successfully Perform Humeral EZIO Intraosseous Access in Adult Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest Patients. So Wampler and his group, Dr. Schwartz, Joey Schumacher, Scotty Bolliter, and a couple of other paramedic, doctor of osteopathy. This is a nice multidisciplinary group. It's, again, really great to see paramedics being lead authors on these studies. So, you know, for anybody who says there's just no research out there, just start reading it. So they, and I think we have to start with full disclosure for this group. They were very good, very ethical about disclosing the fact that they have relationships with EZIO, and that EZIO as a company did not fund this study, but they certainly were instrumental in seeing it happen. So they assisted the San Antonio Fire Department and the Department of Health Sciences at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. So with that said, you always have to sort of take these with a grain of salt, because if there's a product and a vendor is involved, it just has to go into the conversation. Now, period, paragraph, let's look at what they actually did. And they had quite a few more patients than the study we just looked at. So that is nice, because we're looking at cardiac arrest, and the more we have, the better the data. So they looked at 405 cardiac arrests. Now, this is not prospective. It's not randomized. It's I would say, almost a case series here. And it is a retrospective analysis of already the data that was collected for a different medication study. So that really decreases the strength of the research right off the bat. You know, you're looking backwards, you're looking at stuff that was collected for a different reason. So that's hard. And the vascular choice, the choice of access was up to the paramedic. So if they wanted to do a humeral IO, that's what they got to do. If they wanted to do a tibial IO, that's what they got to do. So what did they find? Well, they have a 91% first attempt successful placement of these IOs. And that is a big deal. That's quite a bit higher overall than the study we just looked at before. Humeral access was attempted in 61%, and again, the results here, 91% success rate, and 94% if they considered second attempts. So just to compare apples to apples, we'll just look at first attempts, because that's what we looked at in the article before. And they really only show a 2% dislodgement. Now, they had a much higher success rate on the tibial IO than the humeral IO. Their results show a better overall, you know, I'll find it here, but it's 90-some-plus percent, 96% on the tibia, and then on the humeral insertion, it's a little less. But they obviously think that humeral IO insertion is not only feasible, but in fact, they feel like it's preferred. And so the San Antonio Fire Department standing medical procedures encourage them to use humeral access due to proximity of, I would assume, cardiac meds to the heart and the presumed speed of administration or effects of that drug. So their bent clearly is they like humeral insertion, and they're going to tell us all about it. And good job for them for actually doing it with research. I think there's some serious limitations here. They do take aim, by the way, at the previous study by Studnick. So they talk about how, well, those guys over there in North Carolina, they had a hard time because they weren't using needles that were long enough, and maybe their paramedics weren't as familiar as our paramedics are, and And they emphasize the importance of securing the arm to prevent dislodgement. So I think we have kind of a dueling study group here, and it's sort of fun to watch them fight.
But I think they do point out some very significant differences between the two studies, one of which is the protocol for securing an arm to make sure that they're maximizing the chances of keeping that IO in there. So I think that is one serious piece. And then the education part is always a difficult factor to account for across different paramedic services. But knowing that you are switching to a protocol that is really heavily recommending you use one site likely included a lot more training on that site than another study that was trying to evaluate them equally. So I think it's not a knock to either one of those studies, but I think when you're evaluating the actual methodology behind this, that it's important to take that into account.
Well, and let's think, if it is so important to secure the arm, how do you do that if you're using a mechanical CPR device? Because clearly you need this over the chest to find your right landmark. And if you can't do that because you got a powered device on or that influences that, your success rate may go down too.
Yeah, I agree. I've been experimenting with this a little bit in my clinical practice, and the humeral approach is nice. It seems to flow smooth. It seems to work good, but there's a lot going on in that part of the body during a cardiac arrest. It's one thing if you're doing this for a patient that you just can't secure vascular access, but if you're doing compressions, especially with a mechanical device, it's a pretty confined space.
Yeah, you've got activity in airway management and compression in IV placement or IO placement all on the upper part of the torso that I think as we discussed in the previous paper, you know, what's important to dump a bunch of drugs that don't seem to make any bit of difference, or are you going to interfere with the delivery of good CPR and AED administration at the expense of the patient because you're trying to put in a humeral IO?
So this is great that services are becoming more comfortable with IOs because I think they're an excellent tool, and I'm excited to see the next step. So if anyone's out there looking for a research project, take this a step further and do it in a patient that's not in cardiac arrest, in a patient that you're having difficult vascular access for a number of issues. Maybe they're hypovolemic because they're hemorrhaging. Maybe they're in septic shock and you can't obtain that peripheral access. I'm really excited to see how these different IO routes work in patients who aren't having chest compressions done.
So, great. That's a good segue. We're going to talk about a Scandinavian project. Just before we do go to the Scandinavian one, I'm going to jump out of order here because as we've been discussing all these length of the needles in the IO and the humeral IO, we have a very nice little poster that just got put together at the American College of Emergency Physicians ASEP conference. It was done by Broderick and out of York Hospital in York, Pennsylvania, and it's called The Relationship of Body Mass Index and Increased Difficulty with Intraosseous Needle Placement Assessment of Tissue Depth Using Ultrasound. So what they actually did was they looked at a very small group, by the way, of healthy adults and tried to figure out how deep the needle or how long the needle would need to be in order to get access to bone in these various types of patients. And they looked at body mass indexes of greater than 30, and they looked at 75 patients and really conclude that in the normal sized, they're all obese, right? BMI of greater than 30 is all obese. But in the normally obese, so the not extreme obese, that it would that a 25 millimeter needle is usually going to work here. They've got distances of 1.1 centimeters in the tibia, and then 1.07 in the proximal humerus, and the in the BMIs that were the average BMI, and 2.96. Excuse me, 2.96 is the humeral one. So they looked at both proximal and distal tibia, which were those two first numbers, and 2.96 for the humeral. Now, if they looked at the really obese, which was the BMI of 67.2, those patients, there are five of them, that distance was greatly larger in the humeral insertions, 3.5 centimeters. So it stands to reason that those insertions that were happening, if they were happening with a 25 millimeter needle, are going to be too shallow. It really looks like that 45 millimeter obese IO needle is the way to go for a humeral approach on an obese patient.
And I think
we should just call it the humeral needle.
And I think one thing that that our medical director group has talked about a lot is if a patient is obese, are they obese everywhere? So are they obese at the same magnitude in their tibia as they would be in the humeral approach? And I think this is a nice comparison to show that, yeah, they're a little bit bigger for the larger obese patients over the tibia compared to the group that's not quite as obese. But when you look at the humeral approach, there's a pretty significant difference between those two numbers. So knowing that up front is helpful for line providers to be able to start making some decisions around maybe it's a good idea to just stick with the tibia if you know you've got a large patient. I think landmarking, too, is the piece that is so difficult, especially in the humeral approach for a patient who's obese, because that tissue identification can be really hard.
Agreed. And just to make sure Dr. Burnett's statement doesn't get too overblown, it is 2.9 on some of those tibial insertions. So you do need that big needle for the leg, too. Okay. All right, just checking. All right, so here's, now we've done three out of the five, so here we go. The other two are a lot easier and smaller studies, but the Scandinavian Journal of Trauma Resuscitation had a nice little piece on IO this month again, and it's efficacy of easy IO needle driver for out-of-hospital intraosseous access, a preliminary observational multicenter study. So the Scandinavians were just trying to figure out, is it worth it to try to do this or not? Dr. Schalk is the lead author, and I will not try to pronounce his fellow authors. I apologize. It's just, yeah. Okay. They did this study during a 24-month period, and what's interesting here is that most of these were done by physicians, but pre-hospital physicians, so they're being done in the out-of-hospital environment. And really not much to report here. There were 77 needle insertions in all types of patients, infants, children, trauma patients, et cetera. The thing I found most interesting about this one is that 22 responsive patients, 18 out of the 22 reported pain on fluid administration via needle. So this is not a cardiac arrest population. This is a population, a much broader population. And all of a sudden we've got pain. So IO in conscious patients. What do you think?
I think it's fascinating that they list here that out of the 18 patients who complained of pain, they only gave analgesic or lidocaine infusion to 8 of them. So it makes me wonder why
the other
they
ones could just be in pain.
Right,
thank you
and
very
the
much.
Four patients who didn't complain about injection pain got lidocaine. So it seems to me there was a little bit of selection bias in why or how you're giving lidocaine, maybe appropriately based on the patient's clinical presentation, but it seems like it would be standard protocol. It is certainly for our group that any conscious patient that you're doing this in does receive that infusion prior to place or after placement.
Well, and lidocaine didn't take care of the pain every time either.
No, it didn't.
So just because you're giving lidocaine doesn't mean that you're going to get rid of their pain.
But now you can give them other better stuff that makes them feel better if you get that line in there, right?
Well, it's tough to do to drill somebody's leg or arm when it's awake and talking to you, though, isn't it? Now, clearly we have opportunity to do this better. Are there patients being underserved where we could utilize this more? I think it's just a tough thing to get people to do.
Well, I was just going to say that I think it works great. I've done it before. I've drilled conscious patients.
And you admit to it on a podcast? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I'm glad your medical director's in here.
Oh, I know. You know, and I guess the one experience that I have had with it is that what the patient found most painful was the actual infusion of lidocaine.
It's not the actual placement.
Yeah, and it's more it's more of that, I guess, pressure and the pain that's associated with, you know, infusing fluid into a compartment that's not designed to expand, so to speak. So I would do it again in a heartbeat. I have no problem with
it. Well, I'm not saying not do it. I just think it's a hard thing for a lot of us to do.
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, I was a little nervous.
It's like cardioverting somebody. Hang on, I'm going to give you this nice big shock.
A little bee sting.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
A little bee sting, yeah. This is going to hurt.
It's a big bee.
Yeah, and make sure not to wave the drill in front of them with that big needle and say, hey, I'm going to put this in your leg now. So I just relax.
I don't know about the message there, you know. I mean, obviously, IO is safe and fast but it's painful, and you know what? I don't know. I mean, especially with a diabetic, why not give them a shot of glucagon and wait a little bit longer for that to take place? Because, you know, waking them up and then having a needle in their bone, that wouldn't you want to transport those patients? I mean,
well, so it's a good question. I mean, I think you need to ask yourself why you need vascular access, and if you need vascular access because this patient's getting stridorous and they have an inhalational burn and they need to be intubated, that's one thing. But you're right. I think you need to consider what are your alternatives. So if you have a diabetic patient that is not seizing and you have time to administer some intramuscular glucagon, I think that's very reasonable. If you have a heroin overdose patient and you have intranasal Narcan, you maybe don't need to go down the IO route. You need to ask yourself why you're doing what you're doing. And in certain patients, you're going to come back with the answer that I need intravenous access. I need a way to deliver medications into the vascular space in the quickest way. Pretty much without a doubt is the intraosseous route.
I think, and the jury in reading this paper, that all of these folks too had an IV attempt, almost all of them. I think there were only two, if I read right, two where the IO was the initial first line. So when you read this in the discussion piece, it's sort of like, I think the train's sort of already left the station. People, you know, when I read this, I think, well, yeah, we're already there. We know that IO is a first line or should be considered a first line, and that wasting a lot of that effort.
So for once, the Europeans are behind us? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, isn't it amazing?
Wow.
And I think, I mean, that was my initial reaction to reading this is, wow, it seems like this is already, the question has been asked and answered, and it's surprising that this would be such an interesting report on their part.
Okay, last one. Intraosseous line use complications and outcomes. A population-based cohort of children presenting to California hospitals. This was in pediatric emergency care, October 2011, by Hansen and Company. And here it's a retrospective look at a database that has 450 California hospitals. So huge number of hospitals. Low number of IO lines placed. They looked at 90 hospitals that had placed the IOs, and 239 of them were in the emergency department, 59 were inpatient. So out of 6,660,000 visits and some, they had, and some 2 million admissions, there's a 0.04 per 1,000 ED visits that this thing gets placed. So it's obvious that people aren't doing it for everybody, especially for pediatric patients. It's also interesting that these were mostly non-pediatric hospitals. So I found that to be fascinating, and I wondered if there was pediatric hospitals in this mix and why the children's hospitals aren't doing more IO. Maybe they're better skilled at the other routes. Maybe they're using some other technique. But at least in emergency departments, there were really no complications. They were mostly used for cardiac arrest, and they couldn't find a single complication in the database. So not much here. It's just sort of almost data mining here, just looking through and checking the database to see if there was complications with IOs. Yeah, I figured that would be a wet firecracker. Not a single person wants to say anything. Okay.
Well, I think one thing that would have been helpful for a comparison, and maybe it's in here and I just missed it, but to find out what is the incidence of IV line placement per 1,000 patients, so you get a comparison of how often vascular access really happens in these hospitals, and then to be able to compare that to IO use, because it may be that it's very low in pediatric patients in general, and that we would suspect that IO placement would be even lower than that. So from a reporting, paper writing, just general readership thing to give you a point of reference would have been nice, but I might have missed it.
Well, is this a great example of, you know, Institute of Medicine came out a few years ago and said when something's shown to work in healthcare in this country, it takes an average of 17 years before everybody's doing it. Can we correlate or utilize that with this IO business and say we all have bigger opportunity to use this intravenous or vascular access device? So nobody's doing it very much.
That's a great concluding statement. I think we'll wrap it up. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of the PCRF Podcasts.